This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Stuart Utgard, former CEO of Sportsman's Warehouse. Under Stuart's leadership, Sportsman's Warehouse grew from a single Utah store to a national chain with 73 locations in 33 states. His goal was to get to $1 billion a year in revenues and to then take the company public, and he came darn close. At its peak in 2007, his stores generated over $900 million a year in revenues. Unfortunately, those were also the early days of the financial crisis. Major retailers like Circuit City, Sharper Image, and Linens and Things disappeared overnight. While Stuart no longer leads the Sportsman's Warehouse, his hard work laid the foundation that helped the company weather the storm and survive to see brighter days. In fact, earlier this year, Sportsman's Warehouse achieved Stuart's long-term goal and went public on the NASDAQ Stock Exchange. Join us to hear his story of success, struggle, and perseverance. Stuart, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
So let's start by talking about the early years. You were not the founder of Sportsman's Warehouse. So tell us, how did you end up being the CEO in the early days?
Well, I used to do merger and acquisition work on a consulting basis. And the former owners, Scott Nielsen and Bill Hayes, had retained us to sell Sports Warehouse, as it was known in those days, and Pacific Flyway Wholesale. I forget exactly what year that was. I think it was 1994. Anyway, we contacted lots of people, and we failed in selling it. And so after about 9 months, we stopped working on it, and they hired another broker. And that broker worked on it for about 9 months, and he was also unsuccessful in selling it. So then one day, Scott Nielsen and I were having breakfast at Midvale Mining Company, and he asked me if I would consider buying it myself. I didn't have hardly any money at all. I'd just gone through a divorce, and I said, well, I'll see what I can do. So I managed to put together enough so that we were able to give them $8 million down and a participation in future cash flows. And so for, I guess, many years, I owned 100% of the stock. And that's how I ended up being the chief executive. I was the only officer, basically, for the first 3 years in both companies.
And Sportsman's Warehouse was kind of early in what became to be known as category killers in retail. The audience can think of firms like Office Max or Staples, Best Buy, Costco, Michael's Crafts, which were essentially cherry-picking some of the most profitable departments that used to be within general merchants like Sears and JCPenney's. Was there already a category killer in the hunting, fishing, and outdoor enthusiast market, or was Sportsman's Warehouse the first?
There were really three firms that were pretty well known by that time. Bass Pro Shops was probably the largest. Then there was Cabela's, and they, of course, basically had an internet business. mail order business, and then Gander Mountain, which at the time was running from 30,000 square foot stores. They later changed their footprint to approximate ours in size.
And how big was that?
At the time we were building stores that were generally 48,000 square feet.
Okay, and when you made the decision to buy Sportsman's Warehouse and put together money to do that, was your idea always, hey, this is an idea we could take nationwide, or was your thought you might have three or four stores in the Utah and surrounding states?
You know, when I started, I wanted to have a concept that I could standardize, much like a McDonald's is a McDonald's, no matter where it is. So I wanted to, when we went from the first store to the second store, we more than doubled the retail square footage. And we thought that'd be the prototype. And it kind of continued to evolve up until we got to probably, store number four, right in there, six. Right in there, we started building the same size store. That was 165-foot wide, which later became 175-foot wide and 265 feet deep in the main box, plus a loading dock on the back and a vestibule and entryway on the front.
So let's move forward. So during the first 5 years, you opened a total of 8 stores. 2 years later, you had 30 stores. And 3 years after that, in December 2007, you had 67 stores. That's a lot of growth. It takes a lot of talented people to pull that off. As you looked at how you wanted to build your team, how did you select the people that were going to help you just organize all this and accomplish that big of a task?
Well, I guess intuitively, I like people that were willing to work hard, and that was more important than their educational attainment. And you can, you know, sort of feel that when you work with them in different capacities. And we wanted people that, you know, were personable and worked hard and wanted to do things the right way.
You know, Stuart, this is probably a good time for me to mention that you wrote a book. It's called The Sportsman's Warehouse Story. And it really helped a lot in the research for this interview. And one of the things I was struck by, when you look at a firm like Best Buy or Office Max or Staples, you know, oftentimes in the early days, they had a cadre of Harvard MBAs and people that had done other rollouts. Did you ever think about going that route and say, let me get people that have done this before? Or, as you said, did you value folks that were willing to roll up their sleeve and work hard and say, you know what, that's going to serve us better?
Well, we grew at a compound growth rate of 58%, which meant we doubled in size every 17 months. We had the highest same-store sales growth in the industry, probably by a factor of 3. We had the highest sales per square foot, more than double anybody else. Actually, compared to the industry average, it was about 4 times as high.
And that's even comparing against Cabela's and Bass Pro?
Yes, we were more than double their sales per square foot.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Stuart Utgard, former CEO of Sportsman's Warehouse and entrepreneur. You were talking earlier about real estate, and obviously choosing the right location is really key to success. These are big investments. You don't want to make mistakes. You want to choose your location wisely. How did you guys go about picking your location, and who led that effort for you guys?
Well, I was in charge of all real estate. I found the sites. Later on, I worked with a preferred developer frequently. But I would pick markets based upon density of hunting and fishing licenses, camping opportunities, population, things like that. And then from there, we would look for a site. And our sites had to be a certain size to build a sportsman's warehouse. You had to have 5 acres of ground, essentially. The preferred site was 340 feet wide and 640 feet deep, as I recall.
And you guys preferred to not own the location, but rather have somebody else build it out. And that's a big investment for a landlord as well. Obviously, the bigger you got, the more of a track record you had, the easier it was to get a landlord to put up that kind of money. How did you make that happen in the first couple years?
Well, in the first couple of years, it was pretty sketchy. I mean, it was interesting. The store in Provo, I had sold a man named Dick McGillis, his business, Sunset Sports Centers, and also UDisco, which was a wholesale sporting goods company many years earlier. I think it was 1978 or 79. And anyway, he turned out to be a partner with the guy that became our main contractor, Gary Ekman, in Provo, Utah, on a piece of ground where I saw a construction trailer. And so when I called them up, Dick knew me, and mainly because of my past background, they agreed to fund the construction of that store and rent it to me. After we built it and I looked at how big it was, I took all of our associates out for dinner one evening. Then we went over there and we had big searchlights inside. And, of course, the store is the size of a football field. Turned on the light and I almost had a heart attack when I looked at how big it was. But we pressed forward and we eventually got the store set and open and did some business.
I'm going to go forward to 2004. Life was really good for you. You guys had a corporate jet. What was it called? Gone Hunting, I think, if my memory serves. It was Learjet.
First jet we had was a Premier One. I never thought we'd have a jet, but we did. And then after that, we had a Lear 60. And, you know, we had stores from Tallahassee, Florida, to Fairbanks, Alaska, from Columbia, South Carolina, to Victorville, California, to St. Cloud, Minnesota, down to San Antonio, Texas, and a lot of places in between. So between managing the stores, 5,400 employees, and looking for new sites and meeting with vendors, it seemed like we were always going somewhere.
You know, America forgets that, you know, a corporate jet really can be a good business tool, right? It's not just a perk. And I think in your case, a corporate jet made a ton of sense. I mean, you were stretched very, very thin. As you said, you had a lot going on. You're opening new stores, looking for new locations, and running the existing ones. But getting back to the theme of life is good, I just want to share with the audience a couple more accolades. In 2004, you were named Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year for the Utah Region Retail category. You were meeting with governors. You were meeting with senators. Your son Chris became president of Sportsman's Warehouse. Your employees loved you and your wife. There were lots of opportunities for lots of folks. And a piece of the Sportsman's Warehouse story that many people may not know, I didn't know it until I read your book, is that Larry H. Miller, the owner of the Utah Jazz and Larry H. Miller car dealerships here in town, was on your board of directors. How did you get Larry to agree to be on your board of directors?
Well, Larry was an interesting guy, and how I met Larry, I was looking for a new location for our Midvale store, which was in a, you know, it was a basically a 26,000 square foot store at that time, and I was in the left lane going to turn in by Costco in our store, and the Cadillac dealership on the corner was being tore down. So I made a right turn and went across four lanes of traffic and turned into that place. And I went inside and I asked who owned it. They told me Larry Miller did. And I could see they were under construction. They had a backhoe in the back tearing part of it down. So I called up and asked to speak with Larry. And he was out. And I spoke with their vice president of finance, Clark Whitworth. And I said, Clark, I see you're tearing that store down. It looks like, what are you going to do there? He said, well, we're going to build an office building. And I said, well, you can build an office building any place. That's a real good retail corner, and I'll pay a top dollar for it. And I said, would you be willing to sell it? And he said, well, I have to talk to Larry. So he went in to, he talked to Larry, and he came back like 3 days later and said, well, we'll sell it to you, Stu, but we want $3 million for it. And I said, that's fine, I'll take it. Because I'd already walked it off and knew the size of it. We knew the marketplace that was right a block away from our original store. So a few days went by, about a week or so, and then Clark called up again and he said, Stu, we got to thinking about it and we've got some engineering into this and we'd started demolition, so we think we have to have $3.1 million. And I said, that's fine. I don't want Larry to feel that he was shortchanged. Well, Larry kind of liked that approach, and after that he became my friend and agreed to join our board of directors. That's how I met him.
That's amazing. And how many years did he serve on the board for you?
It wasn't very long. Unfortunately, Larry was a very insightful director. He was there for probably 2 years, and then Larry started to develop some health issues, and he started to cut back from everything outside of his core businesses.
And, you know, as you're growing, I mentioned the store growth. You went from 8 stores. 2 years later, you had 30. 3 years after that, you had 67. It takes a lot of money to grow like that. Mm-hmm. You guys had $225 million in debt from CIT, which is a lender. It's 2007 at this point. The banking industry is seeing things that the rest of the world's not seeing yet. They can see the storm clouds on the horizon. CIT's getting nervous. They encourage you to bring in additional equity. You were fortunate in order to bring in extra equity. You got $50 million from the Seidler Group, which you had to breathe a sigh of relief. They bought 20% of the company for $50 million, which really said before they invested, Sportsman's Warehouse was worth $200 million. So that had to make you feel real good. The bad news is, Seidler said, you know, we're going to put in this money, but we have this little clause we want to put in. And it's called the put. And for the audience, a put basically allows you to sell your investment back to the company. And the company has to buy it back. And you negotiated on it. You pushed back. But ultimately, you did agree to that. Why did you agree to that? And were there any other opportunities that, in hindsight, you could have pursued?
Well, but we had talked to other people, but you know, different. They came forward and were interested in our story, and you know, were willing to invest the money. We had tried to put in a new replenishment system, and a replenishment system ships product automatically to the stores, and we could not make it work. And I think the first 5 months of 2007, I mean, we hardly shipped anything to our stores. I was so frustrated by mid-May that I told all of our management team that if we didn't make this thing work pretty soon, that we were going to go back to the old way of doing business. We had been working on this now for about a year and a half, and during that period
of time. And this was no Mickey Mouse inventory system. This was the best of the best, right? This was Oracle's system.
Yeah, it's Oracle's advanced supply chain. And at one point, we were on life support almost with them. They worked on our case 24 hours a day with programmers from all around the world, India, Russia, you know, so on, to try to figure out what was wrong with our system and make it work, because we just could not ship product to our own stores. And then when it finally did start to ship to them, it was shipping it in huge quantities. So our inventories ballooned in the warehouse, and that was a long story, but that created the need for the capital. Because we had product at the warehouse, we couldn't receive it. So that's another whole long story, but we couldn't receive it, so we couldn't borrow against it because we didn't know what inventory we had, and the vendors were screaming to get paid. So that's what led to Zeiler's investment, which that $50 million came in one day, and basically 3 days later, the money was gone.
So along with Seidler's equity also came a switch. You moved away from CIT for your debt to GE Capital, which is a well-known name. I think most people in the audience would say, well, that's a good thing. You've got this big corporate partner. It turned out not to be a good thing with the financial crisis coming. Talk to us about why GE Capital might not have been the best partner for you at that time.
Well, they were the largest finance company in the world, and we had been CIT's largest customer. And a U.S. bank had been a participant in our credit facility ever since we went from, I think, $25 million with Wells Fargo to $35 million. And they had a $50 million or $75 million hold. We originally had a $350 million credit line. And based on our advance rates and looking at our projections, we had thought that our debt would peak at $290 million, our revolving debt. So when U.S. Bank wanted to reduce their participation from $75 million to $50 million, our CFO and I thought that it would be a good idea because we were paying unused line fees, so we agreed to that. Well, when the financial crisis hit on September 16, 2008, it was a period of 3 weeks, the bank group lowered our inventory valuations from, we had a 72% off-season rate from June 1, or during prime season from June 1 through December 31st, and then our off-season rate from January 1 through May 31 was 68%. I didn't even realize that they could drop it back to the off-season rate, but they could in times of certain extreme cases. And then the inventory appraisals that they relied on were always done by a third party. And historically, those had never changed more than 10 basis points in any quarter. This time, they dropped four whole points, which is the same as 400 basis points. At the same time, they increased our reserve or block of our own money that we couldn't touch from 10 to 15 million. So between basically September 16, 2008, and October 6, they took about $43 million of liquidity away from us. At the same time, the trade was doing that as well.
And, you know, it ultimately had the effect of reducing the cash that you could spend, and now you're in a crash crunch cycle. And I want to talk about the emotional aspects of that. So you're running the company through a very difficult time, which every entrepreneur has difficult times. In this case, you're dealing with several events that really should be once in a 100-year type events that are all happening at once. You can probably see some of the writing on the wall. Things are going to get difficult. You may or may not make it out. You're an optimist. You obviously fought hard and thought you would make it out. But at this point, I want to, from a personal standpoint, had you had any creditor protection strategies for your own personal assets, and were you thinking, hey, I may need to protect what I have in the bank, my personal assets at that point?
No, unfortunately, along the way when you're making, basically we had a cash flow of $35 million, Our covenant was, I think, that it would not go below $28 million. On September 16, 2008, that very day, we also broke our only bank covenant, which was with our B lender, Gordon Brothers, who had loaned us $20 million. It was the only bank covenant we had. We broke that covenant by $840,000, which is about 2.8%. They were talking about whether they're going to charge us a fee of $25,000 or $50,000, and all of a sudden, Gordon Brothers wanted to liquidate the entire company. And that was their fundamental business, is they're a liquidator. So that was a difficult spot as well.
If you're just joining us, our guest this morning is Stuart Utgard, former CEO of Sportsman's Warehouse. So, you talk at universities, and if you had a young entrepreneur that had a successful company that had a chance to get $1 million or $2 million of equity off the table, get some cash in his account, put the kids' college savings aside, how hard would you chat with this individual and say, you really need to take some chips off the table, it's really important? Or would you say, you know what, you need to follow your gut, and sometimes the best thing to do is to not take those chips off the table?
I think it's always wise to take some money off the table when you can. When we were offered, I believe it was 112 or 116 million cash and the rest in stock, a $264 million transaction, we met with our accountants, we met with our attorneys, we met with financial advisors, we had several family meetings about it. And at the time, we were just putting in a replenishment system. We weren't sure if it was work, and we didn't want to sell damaged goods. I should have been happy to sell it and let the buyer figure out how to make the thing work. But we didn't think that way, and unfortunately, with the events that happened in the world, our whole situation, it's not just the banks that tightened up on it and everything else that was going on. The trade tightened up because the banks were tightening them as well. We talked about CIT. CIT factored Carhartt's receivables. We were their second largest account, only to Tractor Supply, doing about $16 million with them. We owed them $5.5 million. CIT told Carhartt that nobody could have more than $1 million account receivable. Same thing happened with Browning. We were doing about $26 million with Browning. We had a $10 million line of credit with Fall Dating. Their bank told them that nobody could be more than $1 million in a receivable. So just those two firms took $14.5 million away from us. And that process was being repeated with countless other vendors at the same time. So basically in the September-October period of 2008, I don't know how much liquidity we lost, but I would say it was somewhere in the area of $75 to $100 million. And I didn't have that money in my pocket.
I want to stay a little bit longer on 2008. You shared a lot of what was happening back then. What was happening at Sportsman's Warehouse, unfortunately, was some really difficult decisions. In March 1st, 2009, Sportsman's Warehouse declares bankruptcy. You decide to sell 15 stores to United Farmers of Alberta. There's 23 stores that are going to close. There's 1,700 jobs that are going to be lost. And you have 29 what you called go-forward stores. Those are really tough times. And you bought Sportsman's Warehouse in a later chapter in your life. As you're going through this, you're in your 60s. You're about 63 years old. What was this like emotionally for you? These are your friends that are losing jobs. You're starting to see you may lose the company. What was that like emotionally, and what advice would you have for anybody going through a difficult period like that?
Well, the main thing was you're out in the ocean and there's a lifeboat and it has a capacity of 20 and there's 24 people trying to get into the boat. Some people can't get into the boat if some people are going to survive. And unfortunately, we were in a situation where if there was going to be a company that survived the bankruptcy, and ultimately about 1,900 jobs were saved, and the business has gone forward to the point where it's even able to go public recently, if we wouldn't have been able to get out of that financial crisis, there wouldn't have been a Sportsman's Warehouse. And at that point in time, it should be pointed out that since October of 2005, when they passed the new bankruptcy laws,
Got a lot harder.
Sportsman's Warehouse was the only retailer ever to emerge from bankruptcy. So,
it definitely got harder.
Yeah. So it was, it was a real hard thing to do that. And what I was saddened by is on the stores, especially where we had to close those stores, they became employees of Gordon Brothers in the short term. And some of the things that they the people should have been paid, they were not paid in those liquidating stores.
Let's move on. Let's turn the page now and talk about some happier times. I've got the date here in front of me now. March 7th, 2014, Sportsman's Warehouse did file to go public. It was almost exactly 5 years to the day that Sportsman's Warehouse filed for bankruptcy. The new Sportsman's Warehouse grew back to 49 stores in 18 states. Which included buying back 10 of the old UFA stores. And they sold eight million shares at $9.50 a share, which was $70 million to the company. Plus, along the way, they had some special dividends that they paid to the order of like $200 million over the last 2 years. And my take, Stu, is that this day would have never happened if you had not purchased that single store in Midvale, Utah in 1996, and importantly, instilled the dream and the aspiration to do this in the company. Do you agree?
There would not have been a Sportsman's Warehouse.
Well, and even I think under a different leader, let's say it got built up to 73 stores under somebody else, I think your stamp is there to this day with some of the senior managers that stayed. I think that vision of someday going public was in many people's minds, and that's a seed that you planted with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm happy for my former associates that were able to stay and remain and did get some benefit out of the company.
So it's been 5 years since you left Sportsman's Warehouse, and you've got another business idea that you're working on. What are you currently doing?
Well, I started a small olive oil business just because it was a healthy thing to do. I could get into it with a minimum amount of capital and be an entrepreneur, and I managed to turn this into a business that's successful and profitable and keeps me so I can buy two tacos at a time. But this other company that we're looking at now, it's a possible acquisition opportunity. I think it's got a lot more potential.
Stu, I thank you for joining us. Our guest this morning has been Stuart Utgard, former chairman of the board and former CEO of Sportsman's Warehouse. His book is appropriately titled The Sportsman's Warehouse Story. Like any good book, it shares both the successes and the struggles involved in building anything worthwhile. Stu, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
Today's show was brought to you in part by Big D Construction. It was recorded at the KCPW Studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss with technical support by Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.